This is an ABC podcast.
March 1st,
1954.
It's Monday morning on Rongelap, one of the 29 atolls in the Marshall Islands, located just north of the equator in the western Pacific Ocean. A young girl, 7-year-old Mina Titus, is sleeping safe and secure in her family home. This is Mina speaking her native Marshallese. What she's saying is everyone was woken up by the sound of a blast. Running outside, she sees the sun rising in the east. At the same time, another sun appears to be rising in the west as a giant fireball forms. Confused, she and other curious children ignore their parents' calls to go back indoors. On Rongelap, this is a day unlike any other there has ever been or will ever be again. It is a day of two suns. What child could resist such a spectacle? Not 7-year-old Mina. For her, two suns are a marvel. But the adults on the island know how the world works. They travel, had a world war going on all around them 10 years earlier. They know about the awesome technological advancements being made elsewhere. And they know a second sun means something is very, very wrong. Mina says she saw something unbelievable. White ash falling from the sky, covering everything, houses, food, water. Was this snow? Even adults are drawn outside to see something they had only read about. Two suns in the sky might sound like the stuff of myths and legends, but how can it be snowing in the Pacific? The answer lies 120 kilometers away, on the nearby Bikini Atoll, where a 7-kilometer-wide fireball has been created by the largest nuclear explosion the United States has ever produced. Mina believes going outside when the adults told her not to took a toll on her body. You'll hear much more from Mina about that toll, some in this episode and a lot more in the next. And we will translate more directly for her, but we wanted you to meet her first and hear her speak in her own voice. The massive detonation that Mina, her family, and her neighbors saw and felt will eventually result in global calls for an end to atmospheric testing, as well as straining relations between the United States and several countries across the Pacific. When the US finally ends their Pacific tests, 8 years later, it will be far too late for the Rongelapese, who are caught in the fallout of the 15 megaton Castle Bravo detonation. For ABC Radio Australia and RNZ, I'm James Nokise, and this is The Last Voyage of the Rainbow Warrior. This is Episode 2, The Day of Two Suns. Seventy years after the Castle Bravo detonation, the Rongelapese communities live in several parts of the Marshalls, but not on Rongelap itself.
So Rongelap Town was created by our local government, and they built a couple of houses for Rongelapese people who are not living on Mediato. But it's a very small community.
This is Eve Burns, a local reporter at the Marshall Islands Journal, whose grandmother was one of those children in Rongelap back in 1954. Eve's 26, an athlete who represents the Marshalls in the 400 meters. She's hilarious, intimidating, and delightful, and very clear-eyed about the history of her people. She's guiding RNZ producer Justin Gregory and myself around Majuro, the capital of the Marshall Islands.
Mindoro.
I'm not saying that right, am I?
Mindoro.
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 Both.
Mindoro. If we do this for 20 minutes, it's probably a good interview.
My great-grandma has Drina Rugalum. She never shied away from speaking her mind. Like if an American kind of acts all high and mighty in front of her, she would always remind them that they wouldn't be on the map if it wasn't for us, if it wasn't for the testing that they did on us, on our islands.
Justin and I arrive in Majuro a week before the 4th of July, which somehow makes us right on time for the Marshall Islands' official 4th of July celebrations, time to coincide with the local US military leaders being in town. The locals call it Bo July. It's surreal. The president of the Marshalls is there. Senior staff from the American Diplomatic Service are there. A military band has been flown in from Hawaii and sung Foo Fighters. The local staff let me steal extra American flag cake. We are asked not to record. I steal more cake. And in the paper the following week, there are 13 pages of adverts from locals celebrating US independence.
Really differentiates Marshall Islands from the other Pacific is that we are an atoll nation.
That's Kathy Jetnil Kitchener, Marshallese poet and the country's first published author.
It's like a string of islands. We're only 2 meters above sea level and there's no mountains at all. So it's very, very flat and there's no higher ground to go to. There's a closer sort of awareness of the ocean.
To the Marshallese, their islands remain the center of the universe, the center of their lives.
Land is incredibly important to Marshallese people because it's so limited. You know, it's very precious. It's like one of the most important things you can own. It's passed down from generation to generation. You inherit it through your mother's side, our matrilineal side. And a lot of times the land that you count as your family's land, it extends not just from the land, but out into the lagoon and to the, you know, ocean side also. When we talk a lot about, you know, when there's different reports about Marshall Islands, they tend to focus on the scarcity of the land, how hard it is to live there. But when you talk to Marshallese people, especially those who are our elders and have been raised much closer to the land, they're able to say, well, actually, that land is where you get all the birds. That land is where we go to harvest arrowroot. That land is where we go to harvest pandanus and coconut trees for copra. You know, like there's an awareness of where you're able to get the different resources that you need.
Unfortunately, though, history often depressingly shows us when you live in a beautiful, isolated tropical paradise, colonizers will eventually show up to do some colonizing. About 98% of the Marshall Island territory is water, nearly 2 million square kilometers, surrounding 29 atolls and 5 major islands. It's hard to say when Micronesians first arrived on the islands with much precision, but if you said maybe 1,500 to 2,000 years ago, you'd have plenty of researchers and archaeologists agreeing with you. And maybe you're thinking, Marshall doesn't sound very Micronesian. And you'd be right, the same way Micronesian doesn't sound very Pacific. In 1788, British Royal Navy Captain John Marshall was returning from New South Wales. His ship, the Scarborough, was part of the Australian First Fleet, and after dropping off a collection of convicts, he was free to go explore the Pacific. He wasn't the first European to come across the islands. The Spanish swung by in the 16th century, dropped a Garaloco con su tema, to each his own, and left. Importantly for Marshall, he was the first English-speaking person to trade with the locals, so British mapping charts named the islands after him, becoming known forever as the Marshall Islands. Ever had someone come over for dinner and then you name your house after them? Me neither. Nearly 100 years later, the Spanish suddenly thought the Marshalls looked familiar. In 1874, they formally laid claim to the islands before selling them to Germany. The Marshallese weren't at the negotiation table. It was a good deal for the Spanish, who got cash, and a good deal for the Germans, who got copra. Copra is the dried white flesh of the coconut, and a valuable trading good in the 1800s. The Marshallese got new landlords. Everything was going wunderbar until 1914, when Japan, also a fan of Pacific trading possibilities, captured the islands from the Germans, building military bases there. Japan's control was made official in 1919 when the Allied powers told the defeated Germans they had to give up all their islands in the Pacific after World War I. Again, the Marshallese had no say. Japan volunteered to take over and everything seemed copacetic. Thank you. With an official League of Nations decision to administer the islands under the Imperial South Seas Japanese Mandate. That is, right up until 1941. On December 7th, 1941, Japan attacked the US Pacific Fleet at Pearl Harbor, Honolulu. A local radio station was one of the first to get the news out. That real war between Imperial Japan and the imperialistic United States rages across the Pacific. The Japanese want to destroy the US carrier fleet, forcing a surrender. The US want revenge. The Marshallese want, well, no one asked them. What is easy to forget in the stock footage and Hollywood films is that this wasn't just a straightforward battle between good and evil. It was also colonial powers fighting for and amongst their colonies in an effort to be the dominant force across the Pacific. Australia and New Zealand were guarding the south. Russia was lurking in the far north, which left a battleground of hundreds of islands between Hawaii and Japan. Those islands were not uninhabited. They had and still have people living on them. People who have been used and relocated and reused by imperial powers like Apache football. People whose spiritual practices are dismissed and whose resources are sold on by unknown traders without consent. People now caught in the crossfire between unrelenting advanced military powers battling for supremacy.
The Japanese began the war from the air at Pearl Harbor. They have been repaid many fold. And the end is not yet.
In August 1945, war in the Pacific comes to an end. First, Hiroshima is bombed, then Nagasaki. There's no agreed number, but it is estimated that between 150,000 to 250,000 Japanese people die. The Empire of the Sun surrenders, with the image of the mushroom cloud seared into the world's collective psyche forever. With Japan's defeat, the US takes over their territories as the preeminent military power in the world. President Truman announces to the world that atomic weapons have ended the Pacific War and that the nuclear age has begun.
With this bomb, we have now added a new and revolutionary increase in destruction to supplement the growing power of our armed forces. In their present form, these bombs are now in production, and even more powerful forms are in development. It is an atomic bomb. It is a harnessing of the basic power of the universe. The force from which the sun draws its power has been loosed against those who brought war to the Far East.
As the borders and new front lines of the Cold War between the USA and the USSR are established, it's clear that harnessing the might of atomic destruction is the new measure for a true global power. In 1945, that's an exclusive Club of One. But even in the first flush of world domination, the US knows that exclusivity can't last forever.
Let's face it, the threat of hydrogen bomb warfare is the greatest danger our nation has ever known. Enemy jet bombers carrying nuclear weapons can sweep over a variety of routes and drop bombs on any important target in the United States. The threat of this destruction has affected our way of life in every city, town, and village from coast to coast. These are the signs of the time.
The USSR, it seems, is close to having the power to destroy American cities as suddenly and violently as the Americans had destroyed Japanese cities. So the Americans must stay ahead. Because why de-escalate when you can dominate? To keep the US safe requires the building of a superior arsenal of weaponry. And to do that, a new test area needs to be found. There are risks in undertaking a testing program. And the U.S. needs to find a way to mitigate these risks.
And here is Bikini, nearly 4,000 miles from the United States, a tiny coral atoll destined for atomic bomb experiments. Here, a long way from the heavily populated areas of the world, the Army and Navy will put the atom bomb through a laboratory test. Here, a whole fleet of iron ships will undergo the attack, observed by scores of military men and men of science.
Bikini Atoll is part of the relic chain of islands. It's one of those 29 atolls that make up the Marshall Islands, 1,000,000 miles from Care and very specifically 4,000 miles away from the United States. And it's here that the states created the Pacific Proving Grounds, where they would test their nuclear weapons at Bikini Atoll in the name of world peace? My grandfather fought in World War II in Africa. My grandmother was bombed in London. The Second World War caused deep trauma, and there was a desire to keep the world from ever going through it again. There's a belief that nuclear weapons will be a deterrent and can bring a lasting peace. But new technology needs to be developed and tested, and there is still so much science hasn't come to grips with. No one really knows the totality of what happens when you trigger a nuclear reaction. A lot of testing had taken place in New Mexico for the Manhattan Project. Even after they started at Bikini, the Americans were still trying things out in the deserts of Nevada and would until 1994. More than 900 tests were carried out there, close enough to Las Vegas for residents to feel them and see the mushroom clouds. They also blew up devices 500 miles off the coast of San Diego and in the South Atlantic. The Marshalls, 4,000 miles away from mainland US, must have seemed remote enough to the Americans to be a place of relative safety to carry on developing these weapons.
Yes, life is simple and beautiful on Bikini Atoll until today. February 3rd, 1946, when there enters into Bikini Lagoon a fateful thing, a grim, huge symbol of civilization in its most terrifying form.
The newsreel goes on to talk about requests to the people of Bikini.
All right now, James, will you tell them that the United States government now wants to attempt to turn this great destructive force into something good for mankind, and that these experiments here at Bikini are the first step in that direction.
The whole thing is like, trust us, we're American. And they certainly lent heavily upon the idea that this was all for the greater good. In fact, the good of mankind, to quote Commodore Ben H. Wyatt, military governor of the Marshall Islands, who held the talks with the Bikinians. There's a famous video of him talking to the people of Bikini Islands, asking for them to leave. After they agree, if you roll the tape a bit further, you can see Commodore Wyatt turn to his aides and ask, "Are we done here?" This request, though, no one really thinks that's a question, right?
1946, the American came and they says they're going to test this great new device for the good of mankind, bring peace to the world, and stop all the war.
Alson Kellen is the former mayor of Bikini Island, president of the Council of NGOs, a traditional canoe maker, and master oceanic navigator. We talked to him on the beach at Majuro, where he runs classes in sailing and navigation. He explains how the Bikinians initially interpreted the U.S. explanations.
It's pretty deeper than we think, because that was just right after the World War II. People still have that picture of the horror in their mind. And they are heavy, you know, they're very strong Christian believers. So when you put war and peace together, anything for that, they're willing to sacrifice.
That sacrifice for the Bikinians is to move off their island, 200 kilometers to Rongerik Atoll. In the Marshall Islands, they say if you take away their land, their spirits go too. Losing your land is like losing your soul. But there's a Western saying that comes up a lot when talking about colonization. The end justifies the means.
And part of what they were saying about the Bikinians are these are a nomadic group of people. Nomadic? They've been there for like centuries.
That's Jack Niedenthal, American-born, Marshallese by choice. He's been a schoolteacher, a financial consultant, Secretary General of the Red Cross and the Marshalls, Secretary of Health and Human Services for the Marshallese government, and a documentary maker. In person, he looks like Indiana Jones with a goatee and gives off a similar academic-slash-adventurer vibe.
And the way they were describing, oh, they're happy to be moving off their islands and going somewhere else, like they've always been doing, which was a complete, you know, load of crap is the only way to put it.
With the Bikinians relocated to the atoll of Rongerik, the United States program of atomic bomb testing and development begins. They call it Operation Crossroads. It begins July 1st, 1946, with a bomb named Gilda, named for screen goddess Rita Hayworth's film of the same name.
87 ships take positions 3 miles off Bikini to suffer the shattering impact of the fifth atomic bomb. Here will be tested the capacity of modern armament to withstand the crushing shock of compressed water traveling a mile per second. The evacuated ruler of Bikini, King Judah, gets a front row seat at the bomb blast as he arrives aboard the Mount McKinley and is greeted by Admiral Blandy, Joint Task Force 1 commander. 25 seconds, 20 seconds, 15 seconds. Dr. Holloway, leader of the Los Alamos group and the entire fleet, waits in almost agonized tenseness. Now but 5 seconds to go, and...
Fun fact, that's not actually what a nuclear blast sounds like, but the recording equipment at the time didn't get anything remarkable to match the visuals, so what you're hearing is what the sound people who saw the footage thought would match the blast. Even then, it doesn't do what happened justice. Thankfully, they described it.
Many miles away, the raging might of searing flame, crushing force, and deadly radioactive water is seen falling in a killing mist as the great circular wall of sea closes in on the guinea pig fleet. The combined forces let loose, swamp the nearby ships, and crush their thickly armored hulls like cardboard.
While Operation Crossroads continues, it becomes clear to the U.S. that they're going to have to step this thing up a notch. Because as the 1950s begin, the Russians are moving at a pace that's getting scary.
1953, the Russians detonated a weapon. It wasn't very powerful, but it was a hydrogen bomb.
A hydrogen bomb. Second-generation nuclear design, allowing for far, far greater destruction than the bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. U.S. President Harry Truman, who authorized those bombings, had said that God had given America the bomb. So the godless communists of the USSR can't be allowed to have even bigger bombs. Truman gave the all clear for a new series of tests, because, as he said,
"It is part of my responsibility as Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces to see to it that our country is able to defend itself against any possible aggressor. Accordingly, I have directed the Atomic Energy Commission to continue its work on all forms of atomic weapons, including the so-called hydrogen or superbomb."
And so begins Operation Castle. Its ultimate objective? To test designs for an aircraft-deliverable thermonuclear weapon. 6:44 a.m. 1st of March, 1954, Bikini Atoll. The Americans are about to press go on the biggest bomb they've ever built. 1,000 times bigger than the bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. This detonation will become known as the Castle Bravo Shot.
The Bravo Shot is what changed, in my mind, the history of the Marshall Islands.
20 miles outside of the exclusion zone are a fleet of U.S. Navy warships, waiting, watching. In a bunker on the northern side of the atoll are the scientists who built the bomb. They're ready, prepared, expectant. A change in wind direction is assessed, then judged safe. The go-ahead is given. And exactly 1 minute later, at 6:45 a.m., the scientists and the sailors watch as a massive blast, a full 15 megatons, goes up in the morning sky. The three islands beneath are vaporized instantly. A mushroom cloud, 25 miles, 40 kilometers high, climbs into the sky, and the debris begins to travel east, carried by the wind. The watching Americans are awed, maybe terrified, by what they're seeing. Thing is, they weren't the only ones who saw it. Rongelap Atoll is around 120 kilometers southeast of Bikini. That's about the distance between Sydney and Newcastle in Australia, Wellington and Palmerston North in New Zealand, or New York and Philadelphia in the States. In 1954, Rongelap is home to about 85 people, among them 7-year-old Mina Titus and Billiet Edmund, schoolteacher. Here's his diary from March 1st, 1954.
It was between 5 and 6 when the first flash came. From threat overwhelming and most frightening event. As the lightning faded, a huge and fiery sun-like object rose up in the western part of the lagoon.
You may find Billiet's language poetic, but there's nothing metaphorical about it. This is simply descriptive, and that's the true horror of what he's witnessing.
It was the sun, for it was round, but it was much bigger than our sun. It was a sun, for it was lighting the sky and giving off heat. Yet its intensity was far greater, and it was much brighter, which left all of us aghast.
The more you read Billiet Edmund, the harder it actually becomes to keep yourself anchored in the fact it's a diary and not the first Pacific sci-fi novel. But declassified US documents and publicly released footage of the Bravo test back up his words. This really happened. He's really seeing this.
None of us could move, but everyone stared at the fireball without a word. Then the queer-looking fiery object became a giant mushroom, and then another, and still another grew upon another. The explosion, the ever-frightening sound accompanied by a tornado-powered wind sweeping through our land, twisting coconut trees, uprooting bushes, smashing windows. Thatched roofs of most houses were blown out. My 10-year-old boy was knocked down.
On another island, 3,000 kilometers away, far from the two suns, from the falling ash, from the boys getting knocked off their feet by a nuclear bomb going off, was a 21-year-old called Jeton Anjan. He's from Rongelap, but fate has him safely out of reach in Fiji. But much like for Billiet, this day was also the defining day of Jeton's life. So on the day of Castle Bravo, the day of two suns, Jeton finds himself in Fiji, now studying to become a dentist. He's 20 years old, soon to be 21. He doesn't know about the bomb. He doesn't know that he won't get to see his land for 3 more years. And he doesn't know that the invisible horrors of Castle Bravo go way beyond that initial blast.
And some of my kids, it took a lot of longer for them to start walking. And even as adults, I can tell some of them may have difficulty, like mental disability.
Mina Titus was there, remember. Mina, her family, and Jeton Anjan will be living and struggling with those horrors for the rest of their lives.
Before the testing, we were very healthy people. Today we are sick.
That's next time on The Last Voyage of the Rainbow Warrior, Episode 3, Project 4.1. The Last Voyage of the Rainbow Warrior was written, produced, and presented by me, James Nokise. Sophie Townsend is the script editor and writer, Justin Gregory, writer and producer. The Last Voyage is a co-production between ABC Radio Australia and RNZ. Justine Kelly is the head of ABC Radio Australia. Tim Watkin is executive editor, audio for RNZ. Faleanga Fulu Inga Stunzla is the content director for ABC Radio Australia. Brianna Juratich-Gregg is the production coordinator for RNZ. Alison Barkley for the ABC. RNZ's Rangi Powick engineered the series. Designed by Dexter Edwards. Website by Hing Yi Kong for RNZ. Huge thanks to Eve Burns, Hilary Hosiah, Gift Johnson from the Marshall Islands Journal. Our respect and love to all the people we met in the Marshall Islands. You've been listening to an RNZ and ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.